All right, now it's raised a good question, because the case of Yehuda and Tamar, that Yehuda had thought that she was a harlot, and in those days, as far as Rishpach was speaking, he didn't commit an avera, because it was, the Rambam makes it clear that before the Torah was given, a person was committed to have sexual relations with a prostitute. So you know, the Torah depicts the situation. He didn't know who she was. This was after his wife had died, and he was out. It was the time of the shearing of the sheep and so forth, and he encountered her, and he made an arrangement with her. But she was very smart. She disguised herself, because she had promised, he had promised her to his son Shayla, and then when Shayla got older, he did not give her to Shayla as a wife. And he was wrong, therefore he was wronging her, because she was now in a state of being what we would call an aguna. She couldn't marry anybody else because of the obligation of yibum. Even before Matan Torah, there was such a concept. So she was designated to the brother Shayla, and yet he was reluctant, for some reason or other, to give her Shayla. So she concocted the scheme to disguise herself as a harlot and to consort with him. And for the sake of having, she wants to have children. Her motives were l'shem shemayim, Chazal say. She was a very righteous woman, and she knew that from him would come forth great people, and she wanted to be involved in that. Now, if you know the story, she worked it out with tremendous wisdom.
Yeah.
And he didn't have any money on him at the time. And so we discussed this one Friday. She took from him things which, his signet ring, you know, his staff, things which would identify him, which were personally identifiable.
Yeah.
And then he sent his man, his friend, the next day to pay, to redeem the object and to pay her. To pay her I think it was a sheep. So she accepted the security, and then the next day, and then she was gone, and nobody had seen her. So he told his man to stop inquiring about her, because the matter can become an embarrassment. Even though it was permitted halachically, but still you have to take into consideration public opinion. People wouldn't understand. Then the next thing is, the word comes to him that Zanza Tamar Kalos Zachai, that your daughter-in-law Tamar has committed adultery. They found out that she was pregnant. And so she was pregnant, so she was an adulteress. So he said, Hotsu Yuha B'Sisara, take her out and kill her. She should be killed for adultery. Then, when she was about to be taken out, she took the object, the ring and the staff and so forth, and she said to send it to the person, and to Yehuda, that is, and to say, L'ish asher eila lo, anochi hara, to the man that these things belong to, that man impregnated. She had the proof. Now, she didn't, however, identify Yehuda as the man. And therefore, Chazal pointed out, as Moses pointed out, that she sort of put herself at the mercy of Yehuda. She had a clear-cut way of exonerating herself. She could have named him. And everybody, of course, in today's society, they would just go out to call a news press conference and, you know, name the person, right? She rather gave him the opportunity. And therefore she said, Mutav, it's preferable to me that I should be burned, the Kishana, that I should burn in the fiery furnace, and I would not be malbim to Nechaver Barabbas. I would not embarrass my friend, fellow Jew, Barabbas. Now, even though she was innocent, it shows you the level. By the way, this Chazal itself will now again cast light on the whole motivation, that she was doing this. She was on the highest possible level. How many people would do that? She was recognizing that the insidious nature of the act is such that it would destroy my soul. I'd rather be physically dead. I'd rather, if I had a choice between the two, I'd rather give up physical existence and save my neshama, have the world to come, rather than save my life in this world and give up my own haba, because I'd be guilty of being malv mechver rab. Now, how does that impact? According to the Rambam, isn't this an issue of it's not a personal thing? It's an issue of l'shem shemayim. This is divrei shemayim. Should be permitted to do. Would she not have been permitted to do so in such case? Monty's saying very good that the situation is not identical, and that was not a situation of rebuke where she had been wrong. She had not. Well, unless you want to say, if you want to say that she had been wrong in the case that he was delaying the matter, he wasn't giving the son shaylo, that's one thing, but that's not the issue here. Then she chose not to rebuke, but she chose a different path. And the path she chose was to ensnare Yehuda, so to speak, into impregnating her. And that worked. Okay? Now, there was nothing. Now as far as in Yehuda's context, he didn't know that who this person was, so he thought that Tamar had committed adultery and she was liable to the death penalty. You can't rebuke him for that. So therefore, the only matter that was left was the issue of saving her life. She could have let out the information to save her life because she was truly innocent, but that would have been for her own protection. That would have been personal. So in that, if that's the case, she said, better I will not embarrass him publicly, and I will even risk death, because if I embarrass him publicly, he didn't do a sin. It's not matters of heaven. It is purely to save my own life. And then in that, when it comes to saving my own life, I would prefer, I'm not going to save my own life at the expense of destroying him, embarrassing him publicly. So that's in line with what the Rambam said. That supports the idea of the Rambam, that you're not allowed to resort to public embarrassment for anything which is personal. Only if it's l'shem shemayim. We're dealing with the concept of mutav shiyu shogeg. That you don't rebuke a person if you know he's not going to listen to you, because, and in a case where he doesn't even know it's usher, and you're going to tell him that he's doing something which is usher, but he's not going to listen anyway. So we say that you're not allowed to tell him, because mutav shiyu shogeg, it's preferable that he be shogeg, that he's doing it unintentionally, so to speak, or without out of ignorance. That is not as bad as if he were to do it to Mazer. So therefore, in that situation, to be a lochiach would be prohibited, because you're harming the person. Which shows that the whole framework of everything that we do has to be for the sake of perfection, of improving the person, not to give vent to any particular emotion. That you see in every mitzvah. There's no specific act, but people don't function that way. That's important to remember. Most, you have some people that like to be the lochiach. They do so, like indiscriminately. You can't have anything which is indiscriminate in the others. Now, the thing is, the question we're dealing with is a case where it's mefurish b'Torah. Therefore, we don't say mutav shiyu shogeg, because that's mefurish b'Torah. So therefore, the assumption is that it's something which everybody knows. He's not, he can't call himself a shogeg with regard to that. Then the question is, what if the category is in the Torah, but the particular manifestation is not, such as a particular malach on Shabbat? Now, in order to analyze that, we're analyzing what is the very reason, as Raphael suggested, that we analyze the very reason for the concept of mutav shiyu shogeg. Now I'm saying that it is not only because if you render him into a mazer, so now that particular avera is worse, and therefore you cause him to do a worse avera. That's one concept. But it also effectuates a change in the gavra. He's a different type of a gavra with regard to the whole system. Now why is that? That's the question we're at. And I believe it's based upon a concept of avera goreris avera, that one avera causes you to do another avera. What is that idea? Say is that at first glance one wouldn't say that. One would say that a person does an avera because he has a particular weakness, so he's giving in to that particular weakness. But why would it entail? Why does it bring in its heels a whole series of avers, seems to be, like it's opening up a Pandora's box. The person has to consider this, by the way. All these points are very, very important to consider, because you know, when you're fighting against the Yetzer Hara, you have to marshal all these forces against it. And therefore, all the consequences have to be taken into consideration. That's what the Chazal say. Bo cheshbon. Make a cheshbon. You have to make a cheshbon. Schar v'era k'neged hefseda. Right? The benefit as opposed to the loss. Cost. What is it called? Cost-benefit analysis. Once the person was over at Roshana, that's without particular. With that particular one. That's right. See, the point is that a person is always struggling. When a person has a desire to do something, and but he's held back by a prohibition, so he's always struggling against the prohibition, against the idea, against the legitimacy of the prohibition. Because as long as he has to accept the legitimacy of the prohibition, then he's in a state of conflict. Then he can't gratify his emotion. And he's operating with certain fears. A person has a natural fear of violating the law, violating God's law. Now, every time he does an avera, he's breaking down those barriers. And if he does it, every time he does it, and he experiences the avera, and he also, see, you have to know, person imagines that something, he always expects something bad to happen to him as a result of the fact that he's in violation. That's like a certain mentality that we take with us from childhood. That, we expect good things to happen if we follow the Torah, and we sort of expect bad things to happen, or we're afraid of. We're afraid that bad things will happen. That's why if something bad should happen to the person, if a person does something wrong, and then a few days later, something untoward, some type of an accident, immediately, in his own mind, it doesn't have to mean that it's true, but in his own mind, he knows exactly why that happened. So, once a person does an avera, and he does it a couple of times, and he's comfortable with it, so then he breaks down, he loses his fear. So, and that becomes like, that's out of the category of being prohibited. So, now, that's what that particular avera. So he doesn't, the next time around, he doesn't face the same battle anymore. He's not involved. It's not an issue of Bechira anymore. He's not involved in the element of Bechira with regard to this. He's not fighting anymore. He's, in his own psyche, he has been Mora Hetel Asma. He's given himself a Hetel. Each person operates with two systems. He operates with the objective Torah system, then he operates with his own personal system. He gives a tear, you know, he justifies things. So after the third time, he's already justified it. His own framework, for him, it's okay. Now, what's the idea of Avera Garosa there? And I think that's connected to the concept of Mutav Sheyu Shogigim. It's a din in the Gavra. And that is that, so we have this concept of O Malcha Shemayim. That's a very important idea. That's the whole idea of the Shema. I mean, we say the Shema twice a day. That's Kabbalah Ol Malcha Shemayim. That's twice a day. So that's a very important idea. That our relationship to God is not simply the belief that God exists. That's the foundation, the conviction that God exists and God is the source of our existence, but that we have to accept God's rule. That is, we have to live in accordance with God's will, with God's Torah, with the system. That's all Malchus Shemayim. That goes against. Now, of course, there's a certain resistance in man. The human ego and the human instinct, desire, the person wants us to live according to his own b'shrivus libo, according to his own whims. Now, that's why that has to be renewed constantly. The relationship to God, that relationship and that subservience to the will of God is something which is vital to man's perfection, and it has to be renewed constantly. Now, when that's broken down, the person is in serious danger, because there's a host of things lurking out there. Averik of Eretz are in many senses. First of all, there's clumps of Eretz. If you Mechal Shabbos, together with that goes eating in different places. I mean, there's an interconnect, there's a network. But in terms of the attitude, once you've broken down that relationship, that fear of God, and the old Malcha Shemayim, so then there's nothing stopping you anymore. That's why there is a danger. You have to be very careful. There is a danger then, and there's a very important point in the Mutav Shiyushogim, because now you're telling the person that this is you're violating a direct prohibition from God, and you know that this person at this point in time is going to has no choice. He's not ready to fight against his instincts in the area. So then you're making him into amazed. And amazed, so he's broken. So in order to do that, he's breaking his whole. He's breaking off the old Malchus Shemayim within him. That's a breach. That's a breach in a fundamental element in terms of his spiritual perfection. So that's the reason why it shouldn't be done. When it's Mefurish B'Torah, so then when it's Mefurish B'Torah, you see he's already in a state where he's a violator. He's not a shogeg anymore. So now it's better to work with him. And, you know, maybe you'll be able to win him back. You can't use that argument anymore of Muto. When the guy's, in other words, a new approach has to be used with someone who's amazing. Doesn't mean, once the person becomes amazing, so you have to mochiach him too. Right? In other words, there's a fine point before it becomes amazing, so then we have to use our judgment. We have to use our judgment, we have to be very careful, because we have to take into consideration that what we're doing might transform the person into a mazed, that it might be better to hold back at this point in time. If there's strong reason to assume that he won't listen. But once we already have classified him as a mazed, so then the whole balance of considerations will change. He's a mazed already anyways. You don't have to worry about losing that component. He's being Mechal Shabbos. So if we're saying that the person is being Mechal Shabbos, he may have known the particular, but he's being Mechal Shabbos anyways, and therefore you should rebuke him. So it might be that even with regard to the particular, although I'm after the argument, I won't start. Questions been raised, but the mitzvah of Chayav Tochiach, it says it's Amisecha, and the Rambam says Yisrael, when you see Yisrael. It would appear from this that in terms of the Chayav of the Machayav of Chayav Tochiach would apply only to Yisrael, because they're deviating from the system. But what about a Ben Noach, who's deviating from the system? That's a good question. That's a good question. You know, offhand, I don't know if it's a mechuyev. Certainly, it would seem though that it's if you were, let's put it this way: if you were to do it, to be mechuyev the person, it's definitely a mitzvah. Definitely to inform the person, to save the person from any avera that he's doing, would be a tremendous mitzvah to save the guy's life. Interestingly though, the question is, do you have such an obligation to do so in terms of Ochea Tochia? At this point it requires more what? Yeah, it seems right. It protects part of the system, part of that which we owe to your fellow Jew, Israel. Okay, on the other hand, it seems to be certainly the right thing to do with regard to a menorah. Whether it's a chiyuv, let's leave that to the question.
Because embarrassing somebody else is very appealing. It's very appealing to the aggressive component in man, because it is a... it's a way of promoting himself, and satisfying his aggressive impulse in a way that he can rationalize. He can deny the fact that he's being aggressive, because there's no visible effect. He's not, what did I do? It's just words. I didn't. That's why all of these, the most difficult areas in terms of perfection, for example, are in relation to your fellow man, how you treat your fellow man, but not just how you treat your man, fellow man physically. See, most Jews don't go around beating up on people. We don't hurt the person physically. We never, but people would say the most hurtful things about him. Lashon Hara is one of the most difficult areas to conquer. Everybody will admit it. There's a tremendous draw. People are tremendously drawn because Lashon Hara is an opportunity to express your aggressiveness against somebody else, all of those emotions, and to promote your own ego at the expense of somebody else, that to live in the world of relative reality. And you have the luxury of feeling that you didn't do anything wrong. It's just words, as though words have no effect. And the person walks away. You didn't punch him, you didn't hit him, he's not physically harmed. And therefore but tremendous damage has been done to this person, but since it's not visible, you don't have to deal with it unless you're a perfected person. But it's purely in the abstract. It's an abstract phenomenon. It's not something which is visible. That's why, even though people will admit that it's wrong to embarrass somebody publicly, but at the same time they'll have a difficult time understanding why is it so serious. Why is it so serious that you lose your share in the world to come? Truth of the matter is that it is really worse. It's worse to embarrass a person. What's worse, to embarrass a person publicly or to mug him and beat the heck out of him physically?
I would say the first.
Yeah, but why? And people that wouldn't mind getting up there and making jokes and, you know, making other individuals uncomfortable, you'd ask him about someone, he heard about some one of his friends that was pulled into an alley and they beat the heck out of him and he's laid up in the hospital for a couple of weeks. He said, that sounds horrible, horrible thing. He'd say, that's 10 times worse. But in reality, it's not the case. Public embarrassment is worse. Why is that? Because the Yadis looks at injury, the whole category of injury, and what the true evil behind it is in a different way than the ordinary imagination. You see, what is the real evil behind inflicting pain, physical pain, on somebody else? What's the reason why the Torah prohibits it? I mean, aside, of course, aside from the fact that, so I hurt you, so what? So let's say I twisted your arm, so what? So what's the desirable thing? Why is it so bad that
you're supposed to love your neighbor as yourself.
True.
And you're in violation.
Yeah, this is more than that. This is an additional in addition to the, you're right, in addition to violating the love of your neighbor yourself.
This is
a prohibition in its own right. It's a violation in its own right to inflict pain on somebody else. Physical harm. It's not just for the sake of society. Obviously, you can't have a society where everybody's hitting each other. But from the moral point of view, what I'm doing is, what is the evil though? Is the evil purely the fact that I caused you pain? That's it. It's a category of its own. Or there's a deeper reason behind that. There's a deeper reason behind it because the Rambam says that the care of the body and maintaining the body in the proper condition is a mitzvah in terms of the alachta v'drachav. It's walking in the ways of God. Because it's impossible. A person is obligated. The obligation to take care of your health is not because we believe in physical health per se. But a person does have an obligation to take care of his health. Why? Because a person has an obligation to achieve his purpose as a human being, which is to perfect himself to the highest degree in terms of the knowledge of God. That's walking in the ways of God. And that a person can't do, in order to fulfill his mission, to fulfill his objective, since he's a human being, he has to be in a certain type of a state. He has to be in a healthy state. If a person is ill, so that drains away the energy, and he can't bring the energy that he needs to the task. That's why if a person doesn't take care of himself, he's really sinning against his soul. He's sinning against his soul in the sense that he's preventing himself from fulfilling the opportunity that he was given, which was to perfect his soul to the highest possible degree. Now, Therefore, I would say that is the evil. When you inflict physical harm upon another person to the extent that he suffers pain, you're taking him away from his service of God. That's really why it's... that's why I mentioned a lot of times in the dormitory, for example, you know, people complain that they can't sleep because it's, you know, late hours and people come in late and make noise and wake them up. So I say it's just a question of ordinary decency. It's more than just a question of ordinary decency. When you take away a person's sleep, it's not just that he's going to be tired. You're taking away his learning. Because in order for him to learn properly, he has to have a certain amount of sleep. He has to organize his life, and he has to have a certain amount of sleep. And if he doesn't have enough sleep, then what you're in effect is you're really disregarding his whole function, his whole purpose, which is to learn Torah. He can't learn Torah, so you're destroying his Torah. That's really what since the purpose of a Jew is to serve God and to learn Torah, so when you're inflicting pain, everything has to be measured from that. From that vantage point. In other words, all of the categories which determine what is a crime, I believe are related. It's only a crime, it's only an evil, because it takes you away from the performance of the good. That's ultimately, if you killed somebody, let's say you killed a guy who was 85, or I'm not sure, 95, how much longer could he have lived? I mean, it's considered to be a horrible, horrible thing. But if you take a look at a different light, you'll say, look, everyone has to die anyways. I mean, why? The way we look at the horror of murder, it's a lot of it has to do with this fantasy of immortality, right? Because when you look at it, you're going to die anyways. Even if a person was in an accident, oh, it's a horrible thing, he died. We view it like it's a tremendously horrible thing. And if you think about it, all right, depends who it is. If it was a young person who didn't have a chance to fulfill this. But let's say it was an older person. I don't mean to demean older people at all. I'm not mentioning it like we said, that's a different, like we downgrade older. I don't mean that. I mean in the sense that you know very well that the person didn't have that much longer to live anyways. But, so then what's so terrible about it? The answer is, it's not because of immortality, that we have this fantasy that if this wouldn't have happened, he would just go on living forever. That's absurd. It's because you've destroyed the opportunity that this person has for perfecting his soul in terms of his relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, because this is the arena. It's in this world. This is the prozdor, as Chazal said, the corridor in which a person has the opportunity. If he doesn't make use of the opportunity in this world, that's it. I mean, he can partake of ultimate existence, but only to the extent that he's perfected himself in this world. Now, if you cut off the opportunity, if a person, as long as a person is alive, it doesn't matter how much time or how old he is, he can make tremendous changes, spiritual changes, in terms of his soul, in terms of his relationship to God, in terms of his values, in terms of his knowledge, his understanding. So by harming him, and certainly by killing him, the reason why it's evil is because you took away the opportunity this person had for the good. But if we didn't hold there was any type of a good, that's why it's very difficult to understand those who don't have this framework. Those who are atheistic, who don't believe that man has a soul, but are humanistic and just have this. So according to them, what's so terrible about killing? I made that point, that if you didn't... Aside from that point, that if one doesn't believe in God, and one believes that man simply exists by nature, however you can account for such a thing, then there's no basis for any type of ethics and morality. You can't say that a person has rights. There's no such thing as rights. Then I can just follow whatever is in my own best interests. There'd be no moral basis to condemn killing or hurting somebody else. Other than you say, practically speaking, we're better off living together. But that's a pragmatic phenomenon. And if I was in a situation where I wouldn't be interfering with society, then the act of killing per se would be, you'd have no basis to condemn it. It's only to be condemned because we exist because of the will of God, and God endows each individual with a right to exist, and I'm in violation of God's will. That's a whole different story. But from a different angle,
I would attack it from a different angle. I'm saying if man, if there's no ultimate good for man, and man is just another animal, so then what am I, you kill an animal for food, right? So what is so terrible about inflicting pain? So let's say I beat up somebody. So therefore now he's in pain for a week, and he can't function. So what do I care if he can't function? What difference does it make if he's functioning or not functioning, since there's no real good that he can relate to anyways? It's just a question of being in one emotional state as opposed to another emotional state. Why should that matter? Now, in my framework, it matters very much, because there is a good that you have a certain amount of time to which you have to relate, and I'm taking you away from that good. That's why illness, that's why, for the very same reason, why you have to prevent yourself from illness, because insofar as you allow your body to fall into illness, you're not relating yourself to, it means you're showing your disregard for the good. You don't care about the good. Because if you cared about the good, you'd want to pursue it, and you'd keep your body in the proper state. Just like the person keeps his car in a proper state because he wants to use it. He recognizes its importance. But yet when it comes to his own body, there he's negligent. Well, why is that? You see? So, for that very same reason, you're not allowed to put the other individual in a state where he can't relate to the good in the best possible manner. That is the moral basis behind the evil of inflicting pain on your bein adam lachaveru, of inflicting pain. You see? It's a very important yisod. If we did not have the idea that man's purpose on earth is to relate to a certain good, which does require that he have all of his physical and psychological energy at his disposal, then there'd be no moral basis, other than the practical, for creating a system of prohibitions, condemning acts which inflict pain and harm upon somebody else. Now, I just want to take it one step further. I think Ellie made the point. If that's the case, if that is the basis of the prohibition, of the category, that when you inflict pain and suffering on somebody else, you're interfering with his purpose, which is to pursue the good. So, if that's the case, it's much worse when you hit something, when you wound a part of him, which is more intimately related with that pursuit, which is closer to the functioning of the soul, and that is the psyche. If, kal vachomer, if you hurt a person physically, so it's true that a person has to be in good physical condition, but his mind is still capable of working. Because you see many people, for example, this physicist, Stephen Hawking. You see that even people who are seriously handicapped can still utilize their energy and turn out to be great geniuses. Because that the physical is one thing. What's more significant in terms of intellectual achievement, in terms of any type of a spiritual achievement, is the state of mind, the state of the psyche. And the most important component is a certain type of confidence that the person has within himself. Genuine, true self-confidence, not egotism, but normal, healthy self-confidence.
Believe in yourself.
That's a tremendous problem. There's a lot of tremendous amount of people, a very high percentage of people, that don't really achieve their purpose, do not really go very far. It's not because they're lacking in talent, because I've seen that. It means that they're very stifled because along the way, their sense of confidence has been broken down. That's a very big factor. And if you have the method of restoring that confidence, and then you could be amazed. These people could turn out to be much more talented than many successful people. And a lot of people who make it, they're not geniuses, but they have a certain self-confidence about themselves. So the reason why Malbim Panecha V'Rabim is worse than killing an individual, because that is just the physical harm, but here you're destroying the psyche, and it's possible for a person to function mentally and spiritually when his body is broken down. That's possible, but it's impossible to function when his psyche has been destroyed.
How do you define psyche?
You follow what I'm saying?
I'm working with earlier on in the work. The mind, the psyche has been destroyed, the body itself has been suffered.
Yeah, when the person, when you've destroyed the person psychologically, and to each person is certainly affected. We're talking about the average individual. We're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't care about what other people think of him, but that's the average individual. the way his psyche is set up, his view is going to be, if people laugh at him, then that's going, he's going to take it seriously. He's going to view himself the way others view him. And once he develops that idea that people are laughing at him, so he loses his feeling of being worthy. He loses his self-respect. He loses his self-confidence. And that is going to really harm him tremendously in many, many ways psychologically. It's going to fill him with a lot of anger. It's going to cause him to lose his self-esteem and so forth. It's going to hamper him in a way which is much, much worse than physical harm. That's why it's the ultimate form of destruction. In terms of this concept, that imposing harm on another person is an evil because it takes him away from his pursuit of the good, this is much, much worse. It's like this, that Tzar Balei Chaim is basically in a different category. Tzar Balei Chaim means you're not allowed to inflict pain even on any living being, even an animal.
Or a worm?
We're talking about Tzar Balei Chaim now. That is inflicting pain on any animal. And the question was, but they're not related to the good, and yet the Torah is called prohibited. It's a good question, very good question. But the answer is that it's in a different category. And the reason, that's another element over here, and that is your own perfection. To inflict pain on another animal, insofar as it's a being which has feelings and will suffer, that's an expression. You're giving vent to your aggressive instincts. And that is, first of all, harmful to you. You're supposed to perfect yourself, and therefore your mercies were supposed to follow in the ways of God. Barachamav al komaso. That's God's mercies extend to every being. That is to say, that every being has a right to exist because God has endowed it with a right to exist. Now, by your inflicting, see, the enjoyment you get is really the animal here too has become a substitute for an individual, for a certain person. Again, you're finding an avenue to vent your aggressiveness without having to face up to it. And you're denying it. You're saying, it's just an animal. It's not a person. Who cares? So, Sarvali, and that's part of the category. The question was raised, what about swatting a fly? So we're saying, if the fly is interfering, bothering you, and so forth, then that's one thing. On the other, if it's not, you can't just go around killing flies for no reason. Because it's part of the creation. It's God's will that these beings should exist. You have no right to interfere. However, if the fly is interfering with your learning, then we have to say what's more in that same scheme of things, it's more good. Your learning is more important than this individual fly. So you have a right to swat it. You see? That's only because you keep preventing you from learning. So in terms of the universe, what your activity is, there is a hierarchy of values of what is more important. That's what we have to take that into consideration. Otherwise, it's going to be ridiculous, you know, the universe couldn't function that way. Now, the same is true with regard to, it's not just flies, but you're not supposed to, baltashas, you're not supposed to destroy anything. Anything of value, you know, you're not supposed to destroy it. It's a recognition, you know, that, you're not the landlord over here. This is not yours. We exist in a world.
Right, belongs to God.
Right, everything belongs to God, so to speak. And that we have to recognize that.
We
can't act as though we're the owners. That would be a serious distortion. And therefore, if God created the being, it's God's will that these, and then the resources, etc. It's God's will that they should exist and they should be utilized properly. By destroying them and preventing people from utilizing them, so then we're acting contrary to the will of God. That's why, I mean, I'm not into this whole environmental movement because I don't know enough about it. You know, I'm always suspicious of the political motives of people. But the general concept that we should relate to the universe in a manner like recycling and so on and so forth, in a manner where we don't destroy the resources, we utilize what we need, and we do the best to preserve for future generations. That's following in the will of God. That's part of the will of God. And to be oblivious to this, to be unconcerned about this, would be an expression of a false type of egocentricity. It means we're totally involved in our own ego, We don't care. We don't recognize the realities outside of our own ego. And that there's a future generations. Each person is concerned. He believes that his generation, he's the center, he and his time, that's the center of everything. But it's not. Take a look. We read Shemos. Vayavos Yosef v'chol echav v'chol ha-dorot. Then Yosef and his brothers, that whole generation, great as they were, they move on in the next generation. Dor olech v'dor bo. But we don't look at our generation. At our, while we're alive and living, we don't look at ourselves in the same way we look at that generation which came and went.
It's a progression.
Yeah, we're also a generation which came and went, except we don't realize it yet.
In the middle of Deos, Perek Vav, Halacha Ches. And the Rambam of it says basically that when you rebuke someone, you're not allowed to speak harshly with him to the point that you embarrass him. As it says, Lo sisa olav chet. But you, in the course of carrying out the mitzvah of hochacha, of rebuking, you should not yourself acquire a chet. How could you do that? Because if you were to do it in a manner in which you would cause him embarrassment, then you would be a sinner. And he quotes from the Chazal, which says, "Yachalat Mochicha Upanav Mishtanos." I might think that it's permitted to rebuke him and cause his face to turn colors. In other words, and even if you have to embarrass him, Talmud Lomar. So it says, "Lo Sisa Lachet." That you should not carry a sin, acquire a sin, because of him. Mikan she'asal adam lahachlam es Yisrael. From here we learn out that it's prohibited for someone to embarrass a Jew. V'chol shechem barab, which means that essentially you can't embarrass, embarrassment takes place even if it's private. Even if it's private. And how much more so if it's public. And then he says, then he goes on to say, that how great a sin this is. Now that's part two. That's part two of this halacha. But the first part of this halacha is to teach us something that I might not have realized on my own. I might have thought that it's permitted. You see, when the Gemara asks a question like that, yachol, that means to say that there's a basis for assuming that I would be permitted to embarrass him in this case. And therefore the Gemara is coming to teach us that you can't. Now our problem was that this seems, the first problem we had was it seems to be redundant, because if you go back to Zion and you look at Zion, he already has told us that when you rebuke someone, whether it be because of personal matters, as we've learned, or whether it be because he sinned against the Torah, so it's impersonal, but you still have an obligation to rebuke him. In either case, he says you have to do it privately. If you go back to Zion, you'll see that Vidavolo Benachas, you're supposed to speak to him calmly, with a Lashon Raka, and using soft terms, and to inform him that you're only doing it for his benefit in order to cause him to have the world to come, and so forth. So it seems to be redundant, because he's already made it clear that that it won't help, that in rebuking someone there's a manner that you have to use, a methodology. There's a methodology to the mitzvah. You can't just do the act of rebuking. You have to do it in a manner in which the person can receive it. And if so, you have to be aware of the other person's feelings. So the first question that we had over here was that this seems to be redundant. In fact, when he says in Ches lo yadabu lo kashos, you shouldn't speak harshly. Well, doesn't that simply repeat what he said before in Zion? Vidabelo benachas over there. There he said he should speak calmly, which of course is saying the exact same thing. That was our first question. The first question was that it seems to be, on the surface, a repetition. And we know that the Rambam doesn't repeat what he said in one halach. He's very careful. Every word contains a new idea. That was the first question that we had. It follows that in halacha Zion, the Rambam was speaking from a practical point of view. from a practical point of view, it's necessary to know how to carry out the mitzvah. Because the mitzvah is not simply to, if somebody insulted you, or even if he didn't insult you, if you see that someone is deviating from the Torah, you have an obligation. That's an inherent obligation, as we said. According to the Torah, you can't assume the posture of live and let live. In other words, that you keep the Torah, so he does what he wants. You're responsible. You have a responsibility to your fellow Jew. And that's included in the category of rebuking. You have an obligation to rebuke him. But the mitzvah is not simply to protest. The mitzvah is to do it in a manner which will cause the person to receive the criticism. That's why you have to take into consideration his psyche. And that's why the Rambam has to explain to you that there are certain defenses that a person has against criticism. So that's what he means in Zion. That you have to take into consideration all the factors from a practical point of view. In Ches, he's telling you an important halacha. And that is that you might think that if it is for his benefit, in order to get the message across, you might have to embarrass him, you might have to hurt his feelings, and therefore, that's why it's a valid question, it's a valid assumption, because I'm carrying out the mitzvah. And it may be that in certain cases, in general, of course, we know it's better to not to embarrass, not to hurt somebody's feelings, you know, to make it easier for them to accept it. That may be true, but there's always the exceptional case, and there's always the case where it might be good to use a stronger method to hurt his feelings if necessary. Now the question arises: am I permitted to do so? And here we see that the Rambam is saying no, that you're not allowed to do so, because that's an isser. That's a very serious prohibition, and that prohibition is not put aside merely for the sake of achieving the mitzvah. That's the chiddush in halacha ches. You understand? That is a new point. In halacha zayin, he was giving you advice and telling you what the best way of conducting rebuke is. Okay, that is true. But let's say in this situation, the best way would be to be harsh with the person, to hurt his feelings, in order to improve him, in order to, you know, remove the problem. And here the Rambam is saying that you can't do so. And here we see that the Rambam is saying no, that you're not allowed to do so, because that's an isser. That's a very serious prohibition. And that prohibition is not put aside merely for the sake of achieving the mitzvah. That's the chiddush in halacha ches. You understand? That is a new point. In halacha zayin, he was giving you advice and telling you what the best way of conducting rebuke is. Okay, that is true. But let's say in this situation, the best way would be to be harsh with the person, to hurt his feelings, in order to improve him, in order to, you know, remove the problem. And here the Rambam is saying that you can't do so, because that's a separate prohibition. And it would seem to be, even in the context of fulfilling the mitzvah of rebuking him. Okay? Then he goes on, that's part one. Now in part two he says that you should recognize that this is a very serious chait. It's a very serious evil. Afal pisha machlan es chavero ein olokelov, even though that one who embarrasses his friend does not get malchus, avon gadolu. It's a very serious sin. Okay. Now what the Rambam is saying over here is that you should not, he makes this point in many places, you should not imagine that the seriousness, in general, there is a correlation, of course. You can't deny that the Torah did not prescribe the death penalty or serious punishments for trivial things. There is a correlation. There is a correlation between the seriousness of the sin and the punishment, of course. But there will be cases where you won't find that correlation. There will be cases where a sin can be exceedingly serious and destructive, and still it will not carry a punishment. For example, he says, one who embarrasses his fellow Jew publicly, this is one of the worst sins in the Torah, and Chum say, Hamal b'nei chaver b'rabim, somebody embarrasses somebody else publicly, ein lo chelek l'olam haba. He doesn't have a share in the world to come. So this would seem to be one of the worst possible sins, and yet there's no punishment for it. You don't even get the lashes of the court. And the reason for that is a technicality, and that technicality is there's a principle that lav she'ein bo ma'isa ein lo kan halacha. That's the way the court system is set up. The violation of a prohibition which does not involve action, and in this case it doesn't involve action because according to the Torah, there's no physical action. Is measured in physical terms. It's got to be a physical action. So speech is not considered to be an action. Okay, it's not considered to be an action. So therefore, the court would not give him the penalty of lashes. However, don't think. You see, don't. That's because of a technicality. That's not an indication of the fact that this is not a very serious crime. Now, we explained, if I'm not mistaken, I think we explained why this is to be regarded so seriously. Why Malbim Pnei Chaver Barabim is really such a serious crime, to the extent that a person ain't lo chelek l'olam haba. Now, there can't be any greater. That's, you see, a person would think the death penalty. If he wants to look at what crimes are serious, the death penalty. According, if you're dealing in real terms, this is much worse than the death penalty.
This is the ultimate death
penalty. This is the ultimate, exactly. This is the death penalty. Yeah, correct. It's a good way of putting it. This is the death penalty. So you're right, the death penalty is the death penalty really is the worst penalty. But what we regard as the death penalty is not the ultimate death penalty. In fact, there's a story about David HaMelech in the Gemara. Are you familiar with it? That illustrates this point. Because David HaMelech, when he was involved in the incident with Bathsheba, you know, if you know the story in Tanakh. And, I'm sorry? The people of his time used to taunt him. Technically speaking, he didn't violate, obviously, the Gemara says that he did not violate the sin of adultery with Bathsheba, because it was arranged that when they went off to war, the husbands would give them a get. So from a technical, it was an avera. He had committed an avera, but the avera, no one should imagine that he was guilty of adultery. But people, you know, he had enemies at the time. His enemies would taunt him, but they wouldn't. They would do so in a sly kind of a way, because the Rambam says that you have to be very careful when it comes to embarrassing somebody else. People are very sophisticated, so they know to avoid doing it in an overt way. Most people are adept at that, but there's very subtle ways in which you can bring about embarrassment upon a person, and in a very subtle, sophisticated way, then you can deny it, you know, plausible deniability, they call it. So I believe they used to say to him, they used to ask him, they put like in the form of a shiloh, you see, and they ask him that if someone has relations with somebody else's wife, what is the penalty? Okay, just to bring, obviously, you know, in the guise of asking the halacha, but that wasn't their true purpose. Badafki asked that particular thing to David HaMelech at that particular time to put him in a compromising situation. So his answer was Misaso Bechenek. His death is with execution by choking. V'yesh lo chel p'yom haba, and he has a share in the world to come. Aval, but Malbim Pnei Chaver Barabim, but one who embarrasses his friend publicly, ein lo chel p'yom haba. That was his retort. That's how he answered them. In other words, what you're doing is worse than anything you're imputing to me. Even if a person did commit that sin, so he's subject to the death penalty. But that's, as you pointed out, that's not the ultimate. Even the death penalty is a kapara.
That was said as a kapara, or
the question that we raised was. It would seem then that to embarrass a person publicly is worse even than killing him. Could be worse. I mean, obviously, from a practical standpoint, there's differences. But in terms of what you're doing to a person, The way we explained this point, and we said that the reason why it's regarded so seriously, because in a person's mind, he doesn't look at it that way. You look at the physical. If you hurt a person physically, there you would say that that's a terrible thing to do. Most people would be very careful to avoid hurting another person physically. But when it comes to hurting a person emotionally, embarrassing, and speaking harshly, you see people are not that medactic, they're not that cautious. Now, the way we explained it was that the seriousness in terms of offenses, bein adam l'chavero, in terms of offenses between one person and another, what makes something a chayt, what makes it a sin, it's not simply the fact that you're causing pain to another person, although that itself is a prohibition, and you know how to cause pain even to an animal, tsar balei chayim. But in terms of Adam, what makes something a sin is the extent to which you're taking him away from the good, from fulfilling his purpose. So if you harm a person physically, what is so terrible about hurting, you give a person a punch? What is so terrible about that, about causing physical pain to another person? Is it the fact that he suffers physical pain per se? That's what most people would say. But we said that that's part of it, but the ultimate crime is insofar as, since it's necessary for a person to have his health, to be in a certain type of a state in order to fulfill his purpose as a human being, in order to be involved in pursuit of the good, so you're taking him away from that because you're causing him physical pain, and not to mention the psychological. You see? So then, from that point, that is the case. If the standpoint by which we measure the seriousness of offenses against another person is not just the pain per se, but the way it impinges upon his purpose, how it takes it causes him to be drawn away from his true purpose, which is the pursuit of knowledge and chachma. So then, mal b'nei chaver is the worst thing you can do, because we said that the psyche, the psychological component in man, is much more closely related to the soul. We made the point that a person can have physical handicaps, right? But you see that they can overcome them as long as he has a healthy psyche. You see people are great. We mentioned that physicist Stephen Hawking,
yeah,
had tremendous physical handicaps, but if he has a good mind, and in fact, in many cases, it increases the energy which is going towards the intellectual, because he's very limited in the physical, the only outlet that he has is in the intellectual, so it can spur him on. Now you see people, who's that Israeli violinist, Yitzhak Perlman, is someone who's extremely handicapped, and but as I said, if a person has a good, he has obviously, you know, you see he has a very strong personality and a strong psyche, so he can still function. Now, I'm not saying that musical accomplishment is the purpose of life, but you do see in his frame that he is capable of achieving a higher purpose. You see, so the point is that in terms of its relationship to a person's true purpose, a physical defect is not as damaging and can be overcome. However, a psychological defect is much more difficult to overcome, and you see that most people that are unhappy and so on and so forth are not achieving their purpose. It's not because of physical liabilities. It's clearly because of they're held back psychologically. And in terms of the psyche, a person has to be well balanced, and to achieve his objective, to really be involved, I would say, I mean, if you study the careers of people who are successful in any area, in learning as well, it's not necessarily those who achieve a high degree of proficiency in an area, whatever the case may be, it's not necessarily because these people have higher IQs. I don't think it works that way. It's because they've been able to galvanize, they can marshal their abilities, they have the capacity to galvanize their abilities, and that factor, the ability, the capacity to utilize, to maximize what you have, is a much more significant factor in the long run. I don't think the IQs, of course, you know, I'm obviously,
I don't subscribe to the view that you can just be whatever you want to be. It's just a question of that's the current view today. You know, like, I don't agree. Yeah, there's certain limitations. And not everybody's going to be a Rabbi Soloveitchik. I mean, that's a but that's we're talking about the gedolim. We're talking about you don't have to be a genius, but to be an accomplished individual, an accomplished Talmud Chacham, everybody has that more or less that capacity intellectually. I don't think there's that much difference between those who, so to speak, make it. And those who don't, I think it's more, it's a psychological capacity to utilize their energy. In that respect, the factor of a certain type of a self-confidence is very important. And Malbim Penechver Barabim, to do that type of a thing, since people function that way, and how society looks at them is an extremely important thing, that can be a very damaging thing to the person's psyche. That's why you should realize, In a person's mind, he tends to diminish the damage that he's done. What's the big deal? I didn't harm him. There's no physical scars and so forth. As long as you can, as long as you don't see it, as long as it's not something which can be demonstrated physically, so you tend to negate it. That's how people function. But we have to function in the world of reality. In the world of reality, so that is you're destroying a person in terms of his true existence. That's why it's the worst type of a thing.
In the last part of the Rambam, however, the next part says something very interesting. Therefore, a person should be very cautious in this area, not to embarrass his friend, and his friend over here means any fellow Jew, publicly. Ben katan ben gadol, whether it be a adult or a child. V'layikol b'shem shu bosh b'menum. And you should never call him by any type of a name which the person feels embarrassed. See, here the Rambam is talking. Why does he have to say that? Because he knows how the psyche operates. Here he's talking about subtle types of embarrassment, which it's always easy for a person to say, I didn't mean any harm. That's what the person, when he says you shouldn't call him by a name, obviously it's not overtly an insulting type of a name. It's the type of a name that the other person causes the other person to feel bad about, but he really can't, you know, like he doesn't want to protest it. That's the type of thing he's talking about. And he says, you should not bring up a subject in front of him that he's embarrassed about. Now, here is the difficult part. When do we say this? That is with regard to matters that are between one person and another. Aval b'divrei shamayim, but in matters of heaven, imlo chazav bo baseisar, if he did not repent, he did not do tshuva privately, machlim mosa barabim, then you embarrass him publicly. Umafarsimim cheto, and you publicize his sin, umacharf moso, and you degrade him, b'fanav, to his face. Umavazim, and you embarrass him, umakal moso, and you can curse him, Achiyach Lamutav, until he returns to the good. Kamosha Asu Kalan Aviyim B'Yisrael, as all the prophets in Israel did. Okay? Now here, the Rambam takes a tremendous a turn, because up until now, he's told us in the Yochal Ata Mochicho. The Gemara says, I would think that you're permitted to rebuke him upon of Mishdanos, right? It says, Velosi Salav Chayt. Now he's bringing in a very significant distinction, and that is to say that because this ties in what we've learned before, that rebuking is on two fronts. There's rebuking for personal matters when he's insulted you. That's one type of a rebuke. Then there's rebuking where it's because the person has violated he's violating the Torah. Now, up until now, he did not make any distinction in the methodology, in the manner, but here he's introducing a very significant distinction. And he's saying, everything I've said about this prohibition of embarrassment applies to a case where it's because of personal matters. Where it's because of personal matters, then you do it privately, then you do it in a soft-spoken way, and then you cannot resort to embarrassment. Okay, and if you do so, then you become a sinner. However, if you're rebuking him because, not because of personal, but because you have an obligation to do so because he's deviated from Torah, there you go through the same methodology. It should be done privately and so forth. However, if it fails to work, boom, then you can wipe him out. I mean,
emotionally you can embarrass him. You're supposed to embarrass him publicly and publicize all the things that until now he's regarded as being the worst things you could do, for which you would lose your share in the world to come. And now you're supposed to do it. The question, of course, is why? What's the reason? If we've already said that the mitzvah of rebuking does not give you license to embarrass, so why should it be any different over here? That's the question.
I would agree. I think that Avi's point is correct, and that is, it confirms what we said before, that you're not allowed to cause another person any type of embarrassment. That's because it's a personal matter. In terms of rectifying the relation, that I believe is what the Rama means. It's where the purpose of the rebuke is because he's offended you. It's a personal type of thing, and it's to prevent you from being in a state of hatred. That's because of lo sisna, as we said. You shouldn't hate him. In that situation, there's a line beyond which you cannot go. It's a personal matter, and you have a right to rebuke him, and the extent is up to the point where you would cause him embarrassment. If that's the case, that's the yachol, you see. If in order to cause the person to change, you would have to embarrass him, then what the Rambam is saying is you're not allowed to do so. And you have to work on the emotion yourself. Because in the next halacha, the Rambam says that if somebody offended you, you're not always inherently obligated to rebuke. You can forgive him in your heart. So therefore, in that situation, you can't utilize embarrassment. But where it's because of Torah, because he's deviated from the Torah, then the obligation to rebuke is entirely for a different purpose. That's because he's destroying his soul. The path that he's chosen is one which is going to destroy his soul. So therefore, the objective of the rebuke is not to mend a personal relationship, but to save the person's soul. If that is the case,
then there's a prohibition against hatred. But there are two methods in which you can resolve the issue. One is direct confrontation, to straighten out the matter between you and him. And the other one is without, no confrontation at all, just a confrontation with yourself. Which of the two is preferable? Which of the two is preferable? The Rambam says that the one in which you don't confront the other one. You see? That shows a higher level. That shows a higher level, you see? And I'll explain that tomorrow, why that's a higher level. But we see that would explain. But what? Why in the previous halacha, when you have to draw the line, where the only way to go further would be by embarrassing and not embarrassing the person. And if you can ask me, so what do I do about the prohibition of lo sisna? So the answer is there's another method you could use with lo sisna. But where the matter is because he's deviated from the Torah, so then the Rambam says that you can use the pressure of the public, because here you're doing it. The person, if he persists in his way, is destroying his soul. So whatever pressure can be utilized, it's better off to do that rather than to let him go on this path. Here it's being done. Where it's being done for the sake of saving his soul, then you're allowed to do it. Where it's being done for your personal honor, then it's a defect in you. That's the difference between the two. All right, the question that's being raised, it would seem that there's a possible contradiction in the Rambam, because in Halacha Ches, he talks about the issue of embarrassing a person in public. And he says that in the course of rebuking, you're not allowed to embarrass the person, even privately. Because the Rambam considers, even if it's considered to be an embarrassment, he means to bring about a certain emotional pain to the person, even if it's just between you and him. And how much more so, he says, in public. But then at the end, he makes what seems to be a turnaround with regard. He says all this, the severe prohibition against embarrassing someone, certainly in public, is only with matters that are between you and him. Now, somebody asked me a question on that also. On the wording in Halacha Ches, when do we say this?
in matters that are between man and his friend. What does the Rambam mean exactly? Does that mean that he's rebuking him for sins? But that we're talking over here about sins, there's two kinds of sins. There's sins between man and man, but it's a sin. But in Divrei Shemayim, where he sinned against God, that is to say, it's a sin which is Ben Adam Lamakom, then if he refused, if he did not repent in the private, then he can embarrass him. So we didn't take up that particular issue, but we did explain why, with regard to cases where he sinned between Adam Lamakom, between man and God, then he can resort to public embarrassment. Now, just want to clear up that point. What does he mean when he says over here, "Bamed Devar Mamurim"? When do I say this? In matters that are between man and his friend. You see that the term "man" and "man" is used in two senses, because we sometimes use that to refer to mitzvahs. Now we make a distinction between mitzvahs that are between man and God, and mitzvahs that are between man and man. For example, laws pertaining to justice, mistreating somebody, stealing from someone, and so forth. Those are laws between man and man. They're mitzvahs. They're mitzvahs. You see, there's a difference in terms with regard to tshuva. We learned that, and the Rambam said that with regard to mitzvahs that are between God and man, it doesn't involve any other person, so you have to repent purely before God. But with regard to matters that are between man and man, first you have to, we discussed this point, first you have to receive the forgiveness of the other party. What does the Rambam mean over here when he says the restriction against public embarrassment I've established is only in cases that are between man and his friend? What do you mean between man and his friend? Mitzvos between man and his friend? Is that what he means? However, if it's a mitzvah between God and man, then you can embarrass him publicly? What would you say? I said that when the Rambam says over here that this is only between matters that are between man and his friend, he means not mitzvahs, not mitzvah issues, but, squabbles between people. That's what he's talking about. Because the Rambam did say that you are obligated to rebuke a person so that you shouldn't come to bear a grudge against them. That's not necessarily if the person did an avera, we said. It has nothing to do with an avera. It just means that in your personal relationship you feel that he's offended you. So I believe that that's what he's talking about over here. And when he says that in that case, and that fits in with our explanation, in that case you have a right to rebuke him, but you have to draw the line at hurting his feelings. You have to use soft words to inform him, to communicate to him that he's done something wrong, and to give him the opportunity to apologize. But that's it. If he refuses to do so, you can't resort to public embarrassment. But in the situation where you're allowed to resort to public embarrassment, that's because he's in violation of the Torah. He's deviated from the path of Torah. So that's why when he says in matters that are between Adam l'chavero, in matters that are between man and his friend, he does not mean mitzvahs. If, however, if it's a mitzvah, if you're rebuking him because, for example, when the Rambam said before that if you see your friend who is deviating, who is involved in an avera, does he make a distinction over there which avera it is? Whether it's a personal, he's eating treif, or he's violating the sexual laws, or he's violating ethical laws. Let's say he's violating ethical laws. You know that business, he's conducting his business in a manner which is usher. So you have a chiyuv to rebuke him, even though it's impersonal. You see? So that category of rebuke would be to bring him back to the good, to chayei olam haba, to the life of the world to come. In that category, you're allowed to use the public embarrassment. So that it doesn't matter. When you're rebuking him because of the violation, because of the obligation that you have to your fellow Jew to see to it that he doesn't destroy his soul, that he doesn't deviate from Torah, that doesn't matter whether he's doing it through mitzvos that are ben Adam la makom, or whether it's mitzvos that are ben Adam la chaver. It wouldn't make any difference. And I think the proof of this is that he cites the Nevi'im. The Nevi'im rebuked the Jews publicly. And most of the, if you check through, you'll see that what they rebuked the Jews for most of the time in Navi, if you're familiar with Navi. It was not matters even in Machaber, how they mistreated the oppression of the poor, of the weak, and the injustice, and so forth. It was mainly, if you go through Navi, the bulk of the tochachos, of the rebuke that the prophets gave to the Jews, primarily was concerning matters of justice, injustices. So you see, and that's where he draws his proof from. He's drawing his proof from that situation to show you that in these types of matters, where it's for the sake of heaven, where the rebuke is for the sake of heaven and not for personal matters, then you can subject him to public abuse, because it's he's destroying his soul. So even though public abuse is a very destructive thing, right? But you're not doing, first of all, you're not doing it to enhance your own ego. Those are the two elements. Well, we said that if you embarrass somebody publicly, you don't have a share in the world to come, because first of all, it's the worst form of destruction that you can effectuate against another person, because the psyche is that component of man which is closest to his soul. Yeah, if his psyche is not in good order, then his mind will be distorted. He can't relate to God. So it's worse than hurting him physically. And secondarily, in terms of your own self, you're destroying your soul, because you're deriving enjoyment and you're bolstering your own self, your own sense of self, at the expense of somebody else, which shows that your whole value system is totally distorted. But in this situation, you're not doing it for yourself. That's why in the case where you're doing it because he's wronged you, so therefore it partakes of the personal. It has to partake of the personal. I mean, you have to draw the line at a certain point. You have a right to rebuke the person so that you shouldn't hate him. Okay? But the Rambam does say there's a higher level. And that higher level is where you, why can't you get past this? You see? The truth of the matter is, we could ask a question. Why did the Torah give us license to rebuke at all in this situation, when you have alternative B? And the truth of the matter is, should we not be on a higher level? Because wouldn't you regard it as a bit of a defect if somebody offended you? So then you should have the capacity. I mean, we're not talking about a child. A child doesn't have the mechanisms. A child is different, of course, because a child is instinctual. So he only can see his own ego. The only thing that really is of importance to the child is his own ego. So he can't tolerate the idea that to live in a universe which is not catering to his own ego, that he accepts. But adults don't seem to be that much different, because the tolerance level for an insult, you see, people are extremely sensitive. They're very sensitive. People are extremely sensitive. And why can't you think it over and analyze the situation? I mean, if this person was insensitive, he offended you, so now you've learned that that's the kind of person that he is, and your life goes on. I mean, why can't you get over it? Why do you have to hate him? Why do you hate him? In point of fact, why should you hate a person if he offended you? What's the cause and effect over there? Does it make sense logically? You'll say because it's a defect. I understand, but that defect existed because up for the last 6 months he was doing it to other people and it never bothered you. So you certainly were aware of that defect, and it didn't cause you any hatred. In fact, on occasion you may have enjoyed watching how he does these types of things, because it didn't hit you, but then he did it to you, and now you hate him. Now it became an evil. So it does partake of us, and it means to say that you are living in a purely subjective framework, because you're regarding something, whether or not something is an evil or not, that has to do with the subjective factor, how it relates to you, to your feelings. When that particular characteristic happens to interfere with your situation, then it becomes bad. But if it exists and doesn't relate to you, it's not so terrible. So you see, that person is living in a subjective framework. So the truth of the matter is, that's why the Rambam says that the next halacha is very, very important, and we should strive for this level of Misha Chata Lo Chavero. If his friend did sin against him and he didn't want to rebuke him or to speak to him at all, because this person was extremely base type of person, or the person is a little bit meshuggah, as they say, you don't want to talk to him, so then he forgives him in his heart and he didn't bear the grudge and he didn't rebuke him, so this is a midas chasidus. Interesting. You see that the underlying obligation to rebuke is not because of the sake of the other guy, it's for your own sake. Why? Because if you say it's for the sake of the other guy, to improve the other guy, so then even if you forgive him, you should still rebuke him in order to improve him. But the Rambam says no, it's only the only factor which creates the obligation is that you should not be in a state of hatred. So this is a higher level, and the Torah, if the person is not on that level, and in order he can't tolerate it, he can't accept it and get past it, so then he does have a right to confront. And when he confronts, so the other person then will soothe his feelings, will apologize to him and restore. So then he needs, in other words, it means to say, there's nothing wrong with it, but it means to say that in order for him to restore the relationship, he has to have the emotional, he has to have the removal of the offense, of the insult. You see? But truly the higher level would be where he... The truth of the matter is, the higher level would be, the best thing would be, where in terms of yourself, in terms of your own self, you're able to deal with it. But if you have a good friendship and you do recognize that what the other person does is a defect, then you're pointing it out to him purely for his sake. You see? That would be the best type of a friend. That would be a true friend. Where you do point it out to him, but the motivating factor no longer is that you couldn't tolerate it, and that you'd be angry with him if you didn't. You see? But you have to know yourself. You have to be very careful over here. I just want to point out, don't, just because I say it's a higher level, you got to be very honest with yourself and recognize the level that you're on. If you don't try and fake this thing out. If you're not on that level, and somebody did offend you, and you do feel this anger, so then you should deal with it in a rational way. Yeah, according to the Torah, you have a chiyuv to rebuke him. Okay. Yeah, what Don is saying is he wants to make his point, because in Tess he says that if someone sinned against you, you didn't want to rebuke him or to speak to him at all because he's a very base person, or because he's a little bit, he's a little bit unsettled or crazy, whatever you want to call it, or sugar. I mean, so why does he have to cite that? Alright? Well, because he's introducing us to the idea of Midas Chasidus. I think that... this would carry over. What about a case where the other person is calm and normal and can accept it? I don't know. And let's say, yeah, why does the Rambam mention, it's a good kasha, why does the Rambam mention in Tess that somebody sinned against you and you didn't want to rebuke him or speak to him? Because, why does he have to mention that? Because of the Yisohed Yafi Yoser. Why does he have to bring that in? That's a very good question, good observation. He simply should have said that if a guy sinned against you and you didn't want to rebuke him, you don't want to speak to him, I mean, whatever. Why? And then he should have mentioned, but you forgave him in your heart and you didn't bear a grudge and you didn't rebuke him. This halacha test would be complete without that insert, right? Because he is extremely base. So Don's question is, what is the reason of the Rambam for bringing that in? That's a very good question. Let's go back to Allah Vav, where he says, "Kishayechta ish liish," when one man sins against another, lo yistamanu biyishto. He shouldn't, bear anger and be quiet. Kamo shenema b'rishayim, as it states by Rishayim, which says, "Lo dibra avshalom imamnon." That Avshalom didn't speak to Amnon, neither good nor bad, he just kept quiet. He repressed it. He didn't repress it, but he did not repress it. He suppressed it. He controlled it. Kisane Avshalom as Amnon, because Avshalom hated Amnon. Ela mitzvah lo dio. But it is a mitzvah on him to inform him, below Marlo, and to say to him, Lomo Sisali Kach Bakach. Why have you done such and such? Below Machatasa, leave Zar Ploni. And why did you sin against me in this matter? Shenemro Cher Tuchir Samisecha. For it says, rebuke shall you rebuke your friend. Vimchazar Ovikesh Menelim follow. And if he changed, he asked Mechila, he accepted it. Zarach Limcho. He's got to forgive. Now, what would you deduce from this, Rambam? Don's case is becoming stronger by the minute. You get it?
In my opinion is, and I think there's no doubt about it, that in Halacha Vav, he is talking about the first category of a personal offense. He's not talking about rebuking because the guy violated the system. Because then in Zion, he says, one who sees his friend who sinned, or is going in the bad path, deviating from Torah, then it's mitzvah l'mutav. So in Zion he introduces the second category where it's impersonal. So in the first case, well, he does use the term sin, but here the term sin is being used descriptively. It's not a Torah sin. It means, well, we, you know, an offense rather than a sin. So what would you deduce on the basis of Vav? Where we're at right now is, what's the conclusion to draw from the Rambam? Is it preferable to rebuke? What's the proper course? Is it preferable to rebuke the person, or is it preferable not to rebuke the person and to forgive him inwardly? The indication that it's preferable to rebuke comes from the fact that when he does introduce the idea that you're not obligated, provided you don't bear a grudge, but that's in a case where you don't want to talk to the guy because the guy is very difficult to talk to. You don't want to deal with him. That Don is correct, the implication being that under normal circumstances you should talk to him, but this is the basis of a heter. You have a heter here not to speak to him because he's an impossible person to deal with. But were it a normal situation, you should. Also, from the way he expressed it in Vav he doesn't give you an option. Where he introduced you to the basic mitzvah, he doesn't give you the option. He doesn't say that, he does not say that when somebody sins against you, you have two choices, right? You are not allowed to bear a grudge, so therefore you can work it over in your mind and remove it, or if you can't, if not, then you should review. He doesn't say that. He says it's a mitzvah. He says it's a mitzvah. There's a mitzvah of rebuke. Now, one second. We're now facing a big problem over here. We've developed a little bit of a problem. If there's a mitzvah of rebuke, so then why should I bypass the mitzvah? I mean, let me ask you a question. And then now it's, the question becomes stronger. Let me ask you a question. If somebody offends me, right? If someone offends me, and I mochiach the person, then I rebuke the person, and it works. The scenario works, and he apologizes, and I forgive him, and we all walk away happy. Did I get a mitzvah or not? Did I perform a mitzvah? And that mitzvah is one of the 613 commandments, right? Is it not? Does the Rambam list it? Ocheach tochiach asamisach. Correct or incorrect?
I think it's not necessarily correct.
Not necessarily correct. We'll take a look at the listing. Take a look at the listing at Deos and see if he lists rebuking as one of the mitzvahs. If I did a mitzvah, now let's say I didn't rebuke him, but I forgave him in my heart, which I have the option to do. But then you'll argue and say, very nice, but you're losing a mitzvah. The mitzvah is to rebuke. Now, the motivating factor may be that you should not be in a state of hatred, but still in all, it's a mitzvah. And we take it for granted as an axiom that it's beneficial for a person to do mitzvahs. We want to do more mitzvahs, the more mitzvahs you can do. You know, to negate a mitzvah. So if I'm going to forgive him in my heart, am I not negating a mitzvah? Now you might say, well, you're not in violation of losisma. True. I'm not in violation of hatred. Right. That's true. But I didn't do the mitzvah. So I take it from Don now, Moshe, is that you're disagreeing with my concept, and you're saying that it's not preferable to forgive in your heart. It's preferable to go through the Torah and prescribe the scenario, and this is what you should do, and you should rebuke, and it's a mitzvah. And the only reason the Rambam brings it in The only reason that the Rambam brings it in at the end, the case where you can avoid rebuking, is because you're dealing with a mashugan or not. You don't want to deal with the guy. So then we're giving you an avenue out. But the preferred method is to rebuke. And I'm wrong in what I claim, that the preferred method is to overcome. The only thing I would say, though, is what the Rambam said, I raise a midas chasidus. Now, midas chasidus means the level of piety. It's a higher level. It's a higher level of perfection than the law demands. So if that's the case, so then why should we not strive for that higher level? Even that's where your question came in, and it was a very good question. So if that's the case, so why must it only be what we're dealing with a mashugim? Why not, from even if you're dealing with a normal person, why not strive to have the midas chasidus? Because I said that if you don't need to rebuke and you can get over the issue without the rebuke, it would seem you're on a higher level. That's what brought me into my conclusion. But of course, I'm following, you know, the exposition of the Rambam, and it seems to be in conflict. Well, how would you resolve this? Say what Moshe is saying. Moshe wants to say as follows: that there are two elements in the mitzvah of Ocheir Tochiach, even in the case of a personal offense. One is for your own sake, that you are not permitted to be in a state of hatred, right? So that's the obligating factor. If that factor is present, it obliges you. But certainly it's a higher level to not to be in that state at all, not to be offended. And even though the Rambam, if that's the case, the question is, so why did the Rambam state, if someone offends you, right, you shouldn't be quiet and be a grudge, etc., you have to notify him and all of that. Why did the Rambam say that you should work, you know, you should overcome it in your heart? And why did the Rambam only bring in this option at the end? Because you're dealing with a nut you can't deal with. So it says Moshe, that's because of the second factor. That the one factor clearly is where you're obligated, where you hate him, where you have the emotion, you have to straighten out with him. The other one is where you don't, and as far as you're concerned, you could walk away from it. But a friend, or a good friend, should notify the other person that he did something wrong for his sake. And that explains everything, according to Moshe. Okay? I think as follows. I think that I'll maintain my idea that the highest level, is when you're offended, is to be on the level where you're not offended, because it says by tzaddikim, they're insulted, now love them, they are insulted, but they don't insult in return. Of course, this is not I don't think it means because they go ahead and then rebuke the person, and that's why they don't insult. It means to say because they're on the level where they're not affected by the petty. They're not living in that. They're living in a different framework. If you're living in a different framework, and you can understand, you can recognize that another person has a weakness, and just because it affected you, there's no reason for you to get upset. So then, kol hakavod, seems to me that's the higher level. I think Ben started to say it. I think the Rambam is talking about the normal situation. Because the Rambam says, lo yistamenu v'yishto. That's what he says. When you are affected, where the Rambam says there's a mitzvah of ocheach tocheach, it's where you've been insulted and you've been affected by it emotionally and it bothers you. Then he says, that's what he says clearly. He doesn't say that whenever a person offends you, you've got to rebuke him. He says, you're not permitted to bear the grudge and to be silent. You're not permitted to be silent. Not permitted to be silent implies that you really want to say something. And you're involved in a conflict. Then there's a mitzvah of rebuke. And that's the situation that the Rambam is talking about. The Rambam presupposes an individual. There is a mitzvah of rebuke, but the machayiv of that mitzvah is that you would be in a state, you'd be in a state of anger. You're in a state of anger. You're a normal person. I mean, look, nothing wrong with that. We all have emotions, and it takes a very rare person that won't be hurt, his feelings aren't hurt, offended in a certain situation, and especially in a friendship, you have a right to redress it. But that's what the Rambam is talking about. But the Rambam wants to introduce that it's more than just a right, it's a mitzvah, it's an obligation, and there's a prohibition. Then, you see, the case of Tess, the reason why, to answer Don's question, the reason why the Rambam mentions the the permission to forgive in your heart, not to rebuke. And then he says it's even midas chassidus, is because he's still dealing with the normal person. And the normal person is offend,